This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So good morning all, near and far, and a welcome to Jikoji and Jikoji Online. We have people who are tuning in from around places. I don't know where all, but it's wonderful. So it's very lovely that those of you who came today could come today. We're beginning, kind of have already launched on doing a sesshin, and that is a dedicated period of about a week or 8 days of really looking into what is this we're doing when we're sitting down on these cushions and zafus, and maybe even we could ask, well, why are we doing this? Sometimes that question comes up. So this sesshin also commemorates Shakyamuni Buddha's death, passing from this plane that we know, earthly. And of course, we're commemorating his lifetime before he died, because that's where the teachings are that we are understanding by simply sitting down on our cushions and zazen. And sometimes that goes quickly, and sometimes it goes slowly. And sometimes we don't know when it happens, so that's one reason we keep aware, kind of mindful, alert and awake to what is going on in our lives, moment by moment, breath by breath, so that we can understand for ourselves within our own body-mind what Shakyamuni Buddha did. He left a lot of teachings, and so did all of his followers, which we chanted some of their names during the service this morning. So we have a lot of help from the past, our illustrious ancestors, to help us go on. So we are focusing this week on the Bodhisattva precepts, as they're sometimes called, and they're also called the full moon precepts, because this particular sesshin, we try to always make it happen, or calendar it, put it on the calendar at a time when there is a full moon, or if that's not in the big cycles, we do it at the new moon also sometimes. But this time we do have a full moon. So that these precepts are ways to help us be in the world when we get up from our cushions, ways to actually interact with the world, with one another, and within ourselves, to embody these teachings that we're lucky enough to have had passed down to us. So all the teachings ultimately that we're following, the Buddha way, as we chant that too later, come from very ancient teachings, 2,500 years or plus old, from Shakyamuni Buddha. And then many people carry that on, as I said. So the earliest teaching is a poem attributed to Shakyamuni Buddha called the Dhammapada, the way of Dharma, the way of the Dharma. And that says in brief, practice goodwill, refrain from harm, clarify the mind. If you go through that little poem, which is a few short chapters. And we here at Jikoji, I don't know how many of you have been here before, but this place was founded by Koban Chino Roshi, whose name we also chanted. And so we'll also be looking at the way he framed the precepts, because there's so many ways to express these teachings, and sometimes one set of words or phrases or one kind of language will really sink in to one person, and another person, a different set will sink into. They'll feel that little aha moment. Oh yes, that's what this precept means of not killing or honoring life. So Koban's precepts, his phrase was this phrasing, which are in the ones we'll chant on the full moon: embracing and sustaining right action, embracing and sustaining every good, embracing and sustaining all beings. So, and that means all the beings that are around us. We're lucky here because we can tune into a lot of little beings and larger beings that that we don't ordinarily see on the city streets. The coyotes and the turkeys and the deer and all the butterflies and the birds and so on, all the plants. So the founding teacher of Soto Zen was Dogen, and in 12th century Japan. And here is a translation of his words: avoid all evil. This is the source of the laws and the rules, the precepts of all Buddhas. Practice all good. This is the Dharma of enlightenment and the way of all beings. Keep your mind pure. Doing good for others transcends the distinction between ordinary beings and sages. So I like this last one because sometimes we honor our teachers and respect them greatly and are deeply grateful to them, but sometimes we put them on a pedestal. And he's pointing to, again, no, we have this within us. That was the original message that keeps being passed down. We are all have Buddha nature, as that's what we're looking at. Where do we find that within us? So these are questions about our lives or how to put these in practice. And that's what the precepts offer us, some ways to do that. So today I'd like to particularly focus on the first and the third and the fifth precepts. So there are 10 of the major ones all together, and they're called various things. They have many different forms. Again, they're called often the prohibitory precepts, which sounds quite off-putting. It's like, do not do that, do not do that, do not do that. But they also have positive expressions, and I particularly like to focus on those. And it's not that we don't know this. It's not that we have to be told, don't do this. We know at some place within us what not killing means. So that's something we can keep in mind. So it's interesting to see how these work together, which is one reason I'm kind of putting pairs of them together, and how we relate to any of them, because they don't always come singly, do not kill. There are subtleties and conundrums, sometimes give puzzles in our life. How do we not kill? How do we not step on every ant? And we don't go to, like the Jains do in India, to wearing masks all the time, so they don't even inhale any tiny minuscule insect. But we do try to understand for ourselves what it means in our lives not to kill, for example. But the third is really one of the major precepts of relationship. In the prohibitory form, it focuses on sexual relationship and not misusing sexuality. But it's actually much broader than that. It really recognizes the interrelationship of our body, heart, and mind with others. And the fifth precept is in the prohibitory form. It's abstaining from intoxicants. But that's intoxicants in the widest sense, not only alcohol and drugs, but all addictive behaviors, including the largest one, the grand addiction and delusion that we are separate selves. We are really intimately connected with all other beings, all life. So here are some expressions for the third precept. Honor the body. Honor your body and all other bodies. Remain faithful in relationships and cultivate contentment. So the do not side of that is no misusing sexuality and abstaining from sexual misconduct. So that too can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. So, and here are some expressions of the fifth precept. Polished clarity, dispel delusion, cultivate mindfulness, proceed clearly. And the prohibitory, no abusing intoxicants, abstain from mind clouding intoxicants. And here's a good one, do not sell the wine of delusion. So do not sell the, for example, the delusion that yes, we are all separate. But in our culture, these two precepts are really strong because we have a culture that has such an emphasis on gratifying our desires and our delusions. You know, it's almost as if they turned the precepts on the head for our culture. Because so much sex is sold, so much diversion is sold, so many material gratifications. So these things don't honor the body. You know, when they say you'll feel much better if you just get this stuff, or you just play this game, or you just connect with this person. So I find them really quite relevant to where we are and where we live. Don't cultivate contentment. That's a huge one. You know, that's the way our culture looks at it. No, we're never content. We always want something else. There's always something else to desire. Entertainment, substances, etc. So how can we look at this? And if we're here, we're probably interested in this question. How do we relate being in the culture that we're in to our actual deepest, truest nature? So first of all, we sit down and really helpful in the company of others. So that's our practice, particularly in Zen. So to Zazen, you just sit down and everything else comes up. All these precepts are contained in sitting down. So that's the first big thing we do, is sit down and see what arises. Trying to be aware mindfully, so not judging ourselves, but seeing when we have a desire come up. Could be, that person has a nice pair of shoes on, or what? I mean, it could be any level of things that come up. Just seeing that for ourselves, that what comes up. And again, it's just awareness. There's not any beating ourselves about any thought or any desire or any delusion. We're all in this together, and we're all just seeing how clear we can be So that awareness and that non-judgmental awareness is really the foundation of all of these precepts and our lives. And that comes from Zazen. Here's a little gatha. A gatha is a short verse to remind oneself of meditation or meditative activities, or there are many ways to express that too, or what we want to touch in our true nature. So the little gatha is slow, stop, sit, still, see. So there's where sitting down allows us to see, allows us to get in touch with what's deep. You know, so there are many real life examples of how these things play out. And each of us will have different ones, although they do tend to sort of come in categories. And they're most often are about ultimately the big delusion of self being a separate self. So sometimes there are a lot of phrases that say, here's Buddhism in a nutshell. And one is, don't be selfish. So that's a prohibitory one, but there are positive ways to put that, putting self before others. So in many different situations, it could come up. For example, we may feel like, well, we're just being friendly, but to somebody, and we meet a friend or something, and we say, oh, and we're just, you know, being friendly. But then we just sort of slide into our own self-interest, our own wanting to be seen and wanting to be acknowledged and wanting to be heard by others, rather than having a genuine meeting between this interrelationship between self and others. So, but we can always tune into that awareness and make the choice to slow down and just stop asking a question, for example. Or just being aware of where the other person is, instead of being aware of what we want to say, which is so often the case when we're talking. And this is a sidelight, but that's a whole practice by itself of dialogue, meditative dialogue. But we can just step back and think, well, where is this person listening to me? What might they be feeling? You know, are we maybe talking a little too much or interfering, not giving them a chance to say something? So sometimes I think, are we content with simply smiling at people, just really letting our hearts open and not have to talk so much or say so much, but just encouraging them with little nods and smiling. There's a famous story of one of Buddha's disciples, Kashyapa, and Buddha held up a flower and Kashyapa just smiled, didn't say anything. So, and by that he was enlightened. So that's the way that story ends. It's a nice ending. So, you know, I like to think of it too as when I get off and talky, just a little light goes on or something, and like, well, am I looking at that person or am I seeing them? And then like letting go of what I want to say. Even sometimes speech can be very subtle forms of selfing, of making ourselves the center of things, like adding something on that's just a little, you know, extra. Oh yeah, well, I did that too, or I know that too, or something, which is, it can be fine to say that, but it all depends on the awareness we have. And this awareness is not like killing joy. In fact, it's really awareness of our basic goodness. We're aware, like, oh, I did this, but okay, I'll move on. And I have this place. I know this goodness, and I can recognize it in others if I just stop focusing on myself so much. So there's, when we see clearly, it's just our conditioning, and we're conditioned by our going back a long time, evolutionary history, and our culture, which is a particularly individualistic culture, which focuses on you do it and you make your mark, and you know, it's a kind of a divisive culture. So, and each of us is subject to those conditions. So it's just recognizing that, and also recognizing there's something under that. Even if we can't tune into it in the moment, just recognizing, even if we go, I'm not feeling Buddha nature, but just recognizing that what we're acting out in terms of self-centeredness. So I like to leave time for discussion, because I feel that this practice is a dialogue when we have a chance to speak, when we're not in silence, and it's relational. So I'm going to end with a couple of poems. And maybe I'll just end with this poem and say one more thing. Because when we recognize that, when our awareness is clear, and we recognize, oh, I'm transgressing a bit, and whatever it is, the fifth, I'm doom scrolling, or whatever it is, I'm spending too much time on this. We can let our lightness shine through. You know, we can just rest in the ease that we've understood something. And sometimes when we are in relationship with others, that's when real friendship arises. And a lot of times in humor, that respectful attention sometimes gives rise to spontaneous humor. So I'll end with a poem by Aitken Roshi, who was a Zen teacher in Hawaii for many decades. And he wrote a book of gathas, which are really lovely and beautiful and funny. He's really quite funny a lot, and some of them aren't. He was a very committed Dharma teacher, and he wanted to bring these gathas, which went on through centuries, about specific points of life where people were when they went to the bathroom, or when they gathered bouquets of flowers, or when they tended the altar. But also in their daily lives, when they were going to the toilet or cooking. So Aitken Roshi covers a lot of situations, and also very contemporary ones. He wrote the book about 25 years ago, I think, as I recall, but they're still very contemporary. Many of the situations, it's about going to meetings and going to work and taking care of his children. One is powdering his baby's bottom. You know, he has a whole gotcha about that, with what he's doing when he's taking care of his children. But this one I thought was relevant to to respecting others. So he says, when joining others for sharing, I vow with all beings to make my report on the weather without making a mess on the floor. So that's what I have to say. And now it's your turn. And also people who are online, it's their turn. We have Susan and Karen and Peter and Christine. And so glad to see you all. And others whom I don't recognize. So anyone, I'll try to keep an eye on the screen, and maybe you'd glance over my good friend and helper, Koyoko. We're all helping each other a lot here in order to make everything work together well and smoothly for a sesshin. It's really beautiful. So.
So I have a question about the environment. So we often find ourselves in different environments, right? For example, when I'm in an environment like this, I find myself very at peace, and I can feel like I'm entering the state of flow. But whereas when I'm in another environment like school, I often feel stressed. Like even though I want to stay at peace with myself, I often find it pretty difficult to do so. So my question is, how does environment play into the whole inner self interaction? Or if so, is the idea that we should isolate ourselves from the environment, or is it to find a way to connect with the environment that doesn't interrupt the inner peace?
And your name, please?
Chahui.
Dr. Thank you very much for the question. It's a very excellent question. Because that is everyone's life, you know, yours and everyone's. We're in the world we live in, we're not a monastery. This is a lay practice. We're not, you know, we're all in different environments, and work, school, family, you know, many different environments, friends, and they can all be separate or they can all be kind of together sometimes. So the basic is to keep cultivating awareness and mindfulness. And you can, in Zazen, keep practicing sitting down, because Zazen cultivates mindfulness in and of itself. That little gata I said does that. So, but that's, you know, making the commitment to do that. It's very, very helpful to meet with like-minded people. So if you have a sangha, a group of people that are on this path that you can meet with regularly, like coming here, you're here today, this is very helpful because we are, you know, we pick up things from others, even though we may not think we know it consciously, but sometimes later it'll go, oh, well, my friend Alyssa, you know, oh, she said something that was really insightful about being kind to someone or not taking up too much space. I hope that addressed some of your question. It's keeping at it, it also doesn't end. No, you know, it's not like you get somewhere and then like you get the promotion. The promotion is to go deeper and see more. Then the more you go and the more you see, the more you naturally want to see. The more your life unfolds. There are little things, and none of us is perfect. So it'll always be unfolding. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Marshall. Thank you for the beautiful teaching and meditation session. In your teaching, you mentioned quite a bit about self and others, and even the emphasizing of self. I'm curious your thoughts on self, how we think about it, self-acceptance, and the practice.
Thank you, Marshall. Well, that can be that can be a little tricky because it's that I said some words, but the accepting oneself, and yet there's famously, particularly in the Mahayana and Zen, there's not self. So Dogen had some of the best words I know, as he often does, as he usually does, actually, for me anyway. He said, to follow the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. When the self is forgotten, all things appear. So, and there are different translations of how he said that from the Genjo Koan. But the self-acceptance comes naturally, but there's a deep conditioning in our culture, particularly to never be good enough. That's what plays in with the fifth precept, particularly of intoxication. You know, we could always want to divert ourselves. We always want, and we're bombarded actually if we tune in to those messages. Those messages are always there in our culture. So, and that happens in a subliminal level. And there have been serious studies done on how, by psychologists, of other psychologists who have figured out how to make that sink in deep to us so that we will buy more. And this is even product oriented, you know, so or action oriented. Or, I mean, an example that's playing out in our political life right now is like, you know, just keep repeating a certain message in a certain way, and then people they won't even know that they've gotten it. But circling back to your question of self-acceptance, one way from the Buddhist teachings is and this is the early Buddhist teachings, the second arrow. So, okay, you did something wrong, or somebody hurt you, that's the first arrow. But then beating yourself up or asking further questions and analyzing it continually is like adding a second arrow. It's like getting shot twice. No, then it just tends to perpetuate. It tends to go on. So as much as one can be aware of what's going on, and a lot of times we're not, that's okay, because there's enough times we are. What we have deeply is so deep that it actually comes up by itself. It's like a deep wellspring, our Buddha nature. And that will carry us through. But it's easy to be distracted and feel like we're not adequate, or we're not, you know, our families might tell us that, or our culture, whatever, our partner even, or, you know, so keep remembering this is what you have deeply. This is, we're following the Buddha way, but other religions, other philosophies that also have this as a central message. But this is the way that attracted us. This is the way that we feel that we can connect most deeply. So keep connecting. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting that development of awareness and what comes out of that, thinking a lot about my own practice at a time of being at the beginning, but pretty hard on myself, having a pretty big idea about what I wanted to be, what this was going to do for me. And then over time, and it isn't all the time, but I'd be able to just start smiling or laughing at my delusions when they come up. You know, they don't come up as much anymore, but they still keep coming up. I mean, that's just part of life, I think. I don't know if it ever goes away. Maybe it does. But just that ability to just to that awareness, just the smile. What I see, and it's not always the case. I get hard on myself too. It's sort of this wave that moves through life in terms of delusions and awareness of them and smiling at them and being angry, you know, being hard on us. It's an interesting dance, and this practice just allows you to see it better, I guess. I don't know.
Thank you so much. That's a beautiful expression of the way we are. Yeah, and humor is really important, and laughing at ourselves. That's all spontaneous too, as you described. It's beautiful. Thank you so much. We just keep at it, and the wave. I really like that metaphor. The wave just keeps going on, but maybe it's not so monster wave like it was at the beginning. You know, we're definitely surfing. Thank you. Yes, Anton.
Yeah. Thanks for your Dharma talk. It was really, really beautiful. What I wanted to say or ask a question about is, when we read about people transforming, like you read some koans and we see monks get, you know, transformed or enlightened. But what I'm curious about is, like, can we say similar about humanity in general? Is it possible to observe how we learn?
So I didn't catch quite all that. Is it possible how they...
To see how humanity is learning. Is it possible to see? Because, like, if you see on a human arc, you can see how people change through the course of their lives. Can we see something similar about people in general?
Yes. That's a really big question. I would say that there are different views on that. I can give you my view. It's not necessarily, to my knowledge, addressed specifically in the early teachings or in the Mahayana, and I don't know very much of the Vajrayana. But my own view is that yes, that you can see. The historical record is just the historical record, let's say, because that's all we really have. Even mythology is already history because it's been passed on through language. So I would say overall, yes, that there is an arc, but that doesn't mean that in a way it relates to just keeping practicing, as you know, just keeping on the waves, because there will always be and there will always be that other side of human nature, the more surface, the more hardwired, deeply embedded reactivity. The feeling of fear is the basis of people like going, protecting themselves in whatever way, large or small. So I'll say one thing I mentioned yesterday, Anton, we were talking a little bit yesterday about the Dhammapada, and this does address in a kind of an abstract way, borne out by history, as far as I read the historical record, that the second verse, hatred is never conquered by hatred. Love alone vanquishes hatred. So that's the early teachings of the Buddha in verse form. You can, if you look at how things were, say, during the Greek and Roman era, there was a lot of separation. There was slavery of everyone except to this small group of men who were born into a certain small segment of society. But as we know, in our own American history, these things take a long time to play out. Also, the words of Martin Luther King come to mind, and some people don't agree with that, but you have to keep going on. And I think that those people, I speak for myself, and that people who have a kind of an essentially positive view of human nature, but recognize somehow that they haven't gotten in touch with their own, come to Buddhist practice. So it's a way of keeping in touch with what human nature really is and can manifest as, can be. And it's not that Buddhists even today don't kill each other, sadly. It's not to deny that any of that goes on. But so I don't know if I've answered your question, but I'll try to address it in some manner. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have time for one more question before it's lunchtime. We have a Tenzo here who's taking care of us, our cook, and we like to honor and respect her timing because she does such hard work for us. So, Mariko.
Thank you for your talk. I had a question about what you were talking about, self-awareness, and in life, in our families and work life, it's not hard to come across people that aren't self-aware and are always injecting themselves into stuff. So is there a skillful way to point it out, or is that not our place? should we just continue and just try to deal with ourselves and hopefully somehow be an example for them somehow later? Or is there something we can skillfully say? Like, for instance, if you're dealing with a loved one.
Being with loved ones, family, that's often brings things into sharp relief where there's a disconnect between our deepest knowledge and aspiration to embody that knowledge, and yet we have these deep intimate relationships that we may not even know what all the conditions that brought us to this point where there's some kind of conflict or something. So in general, I would say that the first thing is it to be aware ourselves and to let go, to not hold on to this is my view. Actually, Aitken Roshi, I thought about a lot of his gathas because I love them, and I'm teaching this week, so I brought some with me. And he has one that addresses when someone says that I take strong exception to or disagree with, I vow with all beings to listen as deeply as I can and ignore the manner of speaking or the way that this person's. Another way you could look at that is to really go deeper in yourself in order to meet a person and see relate to, and this is all kind of awkward to talk about it because it's contextual. Most often relationships are in the moment, but can you you feel like, well, they're having some difficulty. They're having some large or small, whatever level it is. And so can I just feel the compassion for them in a simple way? And maybe not using that words, but just tuning into the body. Tuning into the body is always a good way to try to know where the next thing comes, because there's no way to say what's a skillful phrase, or that will be always in the moment, but they do arise when you do feel the compassion, feel the loving kindness. We'll talk about that more tomorrow. So we'll address this a little more deeply tomorrow. Thank you for that.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.